All right, well, I'm gonna get started. So if you're here for the discussion on Bible stories, wrong room.
What's your story?
Yeah, I have lots of stories, but not as in those.
But there's a What's Your Story program next door.
Next door, exactly. Right. Thank you. Yes. So I'm Jamie Schick. I'm here doing some lectures this week on various geology topics. And this week, or today, I'm doing kind of an optimistic whirlwind tour of the Pacific Northwest. It's an amazingly diverse region and deserves a lot more than 45 minutes. But I'm going to give it a shot. And this is a great picture out near Ontario. There's actually a huge landslide that goes all the way across this through a big backscarp up there. But that was yesterday's talk. So there are a variety of physiographic provinces that they've broken the Pacific Northwest into, just based on general geology, geologic history, rock type, age rocks. And this particular, it's not a great map. This is California, Nevada, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. And then they've sort of taken these and blown them up into individual ones. I've kind of intentionally hacked off the top part because it's a really interesting story, but we're not going to go down to up to British Columbia. I am going to talk about the Columbia Plateau. I'm going to talk about the Snake River Plains and the Basin and Range. I'm not going to talk about the Klamath and the Blue Mountains. Just from a time standpoint, they're also interesting accreted terrains, but I'm going to talk about the Coast Range and the Cascade Mountains. So for those that attended yesterday, Tuesday, Monday, they saw this slide. I'm going to show it again and talk just a little bit about it. So this is this general geologic scenario has been repeated along the Oregon coastline, Pacific Northwest coastline, for the last 300 to 400 million years in varying degrees. And depending on how fast things have been coming together, has an impact on this subduction zone. So this is a subduction zone where you have ocean crust going underneath the continental crust. The ocean crust goes down, and it says melting here, and that's a little bit deceiving. What really is happening is that this material has a lot of water in it. And you get to a point where the water starts to volatilize out of this slab, and then it actually starts, that water reduces the melting temperature of the mantle, and that's where you start getting liquid rock. So it's a little bit deceiving that it does eventually melt, but not to form volcanoes. You have other effects as this plate sort of changes. You can get spreading tension in the back, and that creates eruptions of volcanics. You can even get that in front a little bit as well. So there's all kinds of great stuff that goes on along these continental oceanic subduction zones. A little sense of time that we'll be talking about today. I'm going to pretty much write off the first three quarters of the world's history. I can't go down that path. But we do have rocks here in the Pacific Northwest that cover all the range of the rainbow here. Most of the action was in the last 66 million years or so. I'm going to kind of run to that point fairly quickly here. But just to give you a sense, some of the time frames that I'm talking about, we'll be talking about the Eocene is 60 to 35-ish, plus or minus. Then the Oligocene, the Miocene, we had a lot of activity going on. And then even more recently, right up to the present, there's quite a bit of geologic history in the Pacific Northwest. I thought this was interesting. This is actually before some folks may have heard of this very large supercontinent called Pangaea. And even before that, there was another supercontinent. So it's kind of come together and blown apart and come together. And so actually, the North American Craton's sister craton, if you will, is actually Siberia, which I thought was really interesting. So there's a long history of the plates coming together and moving apart, and that's what we'll see. So about 300 million years ago, the coastline was actually over in Montana. This was all shallow marine. There were various volcanoes out in the middle of the ocean, and this was not a subduction zone. This was a stable continental margin. But things started to shift. The ocean crust started to move towards the very dense and more buoyant craton, and usually when that happens, the ocean crust loses and goes down the hole. And that's what we had here. So for the next several hundred million years, we did have some of these, but this is not what was going on, and it wasn't quite as exciting. But it was pretty amazing. Over the next, from 300 to around 70 million years ago, we had one chunk of ocean crust and chunks of exotic terrains, if you will, places, you know, rocks that came from great distances, you know, thousands of miles away, that just like a conveyor belt, they just came along and they were what we call accreted onto the North American craton. So in doing so, these would get thrust over on top of each other, buried, exhumed. It was really pretty active time, such that around 70 million years ago, this was kind of where we were. You know, we're still, you know, east of where we are now. Actually, we're pretty close. We were probably on ground there. I don't want people to think that this is really what it looked like, because the North American continent was a lot further south than it is today. And it's been kind of moving north. It's actually, I think it's starting to move south again. But just for a reference point, you'll see a lot of diagrams like this, and it gives you a sense, at least of to relative standpoint, where things are at. Notice that there's no Columbia River, there's no Cascade Range. It's a very different looking topography, but it does have over 100 exotic terrains attached to its side. So this is kind of a busy diagram, I apologize. These are four different images of what the plates, so this would be North America and various ocean plates, were doing over time. 100 million years ago, we were still adding some terrains to the coastline, but by 65 million years ago, we were pretty much done with that. There were some local volcanics that were attached to the Pacific Northwest, which are now part of the Coast Range. Plates had started to separate. We initially had a single large Farallon plate that actually rifted apart, and the Kula plate started heading up north. Subduction zone changed, or subduction rates changed, and volcanism shifted off to the east at that point. By 30 million years ago, they call that the Upper Eocene, accretion was done for the most part. Subduction rates were changing, and that changed the angle of the subducting slab. And essentially, this is—it's sort of counterintuitive. You think if something's moving really fast, it's going to stay shallow and shoot across. But what actually was happening is that because you get cooler ocean crust in there, it starts to actually sink faster. So it actually steepens instead of going shallower. And so what you had was this was kind of the precursor to the Western volcanics, the Western Cascades. So there was a lot of volcanism that kicked off in the 35 million years ago or so. Let's go back. So I'm just going to, just a quick summary, 55 to 35 million years ago, which is all kind of a crazy time frame, but subduction was changing. What happened is we actually got extension out to the east that created a lot of explosive volcanism. There's a lot of ash sheets. The John Day Formation or the Carnot Formation, which are famous for fossils, were being created at those times. As you got a little bit more recent, 35 million years ago or so, you started getting Western Cascades being developed, and that had a significant effect on a variety of things, including our weather patterns, water flow, geology, of course. So the light tan is what's called the Western Cascades. It's a really complex series of both like basalts as well as more rhyolitic, which is more of a high silica lava explosions and eruptions, lots of mud flows and debris flows. It's a really complicated area, and it's heavily incised. So as far as mapping, if you go to geologic maps of these areas, they're just, it's like, it's not a very technical term, but it's garbage lumping. So basically you've got lots of different things, they're all volcanic origin, but it's basically impossible to map just because of the incision and the weathering that's occurred. You'll have a plug in one location and old lahar flows and mud flows that are all basically weak rock and spread around. You'll notice how lush it is, and that's there was enough volcanism produced and uplift associated with the ongoing subduction kind of pushing things together that essentially you change the weather system of the Pacific Northwest. So prior to the Western Cascades forming, the rains would come across and would just continue right through. So you didn't have this concentration of moisture along the western end of the continent. This volcanic period essentially changed all that, forced the clouds to go up, drop their load, and then they had not much left. So the western, eastern Pacific Northwest became much drier. About 9 to 10 million years ago, the subduction, rate of subduction started to decrease, and that shifted the volcanism a little bit east. You saw in that previous picture the more dark brown was a little bit east. Here that's been repeated. These are the various active vents here now. And it was a little less intense and more less explosive. St. Helens being maybe an exception to that. This is the Three Sisters Wilderness. It's one of the Three Sisters area, south, middle, north. That's actually Broken Top, which is a slightly older volcano. These are all, at least the middle and south are considered relatively active today. And it extends well up into British Columbia. This is actually Mount Baker, north side of Mount Baker. I think this is the Coleman Glacier right here, for those that have a reference there. A beautiful mountain. So that's north. That's the Cascades, the volcanoes that we see today. The Columbia River basalts are, in my mind, perhaps one of the more amazing sort of geologic phenomena of the Pacific Northwest. These were erupted during the Miocene, 15 million years ago or so, mostly from fissures to the east in both Idaho and eastern Oregon. These fissures were up to 100 miles long, so intense openings in the crust. Extremely effusive eruptions that made it all the way to the Oregon coast. And I think on the order of 5,000 to 7,000 feet thick in the Yakima area. And enough eruptions that essentially it actually forced the crust to sink because they put so much weight on top. I'm not going to go through all these lava flows, so don't worry about that. Probably 6 major eruptive events with over 300 individual flows that have been mapped. Very productive lava flows. This is a view in the gorge, stack of lava flows. Had huge impacts on drainage. The Columbia River was altered its course multiple times because obviously lava flow takes the lowest path and takes that up, which is usually the river. It's got to go somewhere else. If you look at the Snake River, it takes a big dive around to get around a lot of the flows. Approximately 42,000 cubic miles of lava, which I can't even really sort of put into vision beyond it, sort of covering a third of Washington and being 7,000 feet deep. But it's interesting. One of the things about that is it seems like, it must have been just flowing continuously for millions of years. But the actual rate of eruption was on average 1 to 35,000 years. So you could go a long time without ever, mankind would have never noticed that there were lava flows everywhere. But this rhinoceros sure did. And I heard about this a long time ago, and this was, I thought it was a bit of a wise tale, and I did a little more digging, and it's true. There's actually a cast near George Washington where one of these lava flows trapped a rhino and basically created a cast out of the poor guy. It was pretty quick. And, you know, he must have been trapped because I think they can move faster than about 3 miles an hour, which is the average rate of water flow. But apparently not fast enough. So I wanted to talk about Missoula floods here because they had a significant impact on the surface morphology of the Columbia River basalt. It's a very recent phenomena event. Had a huge impact in the Portland area, so we think about this all the time as far as the soils and near surface materials. During the last ice age, somewhere between 15 and 12,500 years ago, glaciers had advanced to about their maximum extent, and in fact, the Continental Glacier had actually created an ice dam and created this glacial Lake Missoula. And if you get on YouTube, there's actually, down in Patagonia, there's an ice dam right now that blows out every 5-10 years, and they have some great footage. This was a much bigger scale. Essentially, that failed catastrophically, flowing at something like 9 cubic miles per hour or something like that, which is an incredible flow. Spread out across eastern Washington, channeled down Wallula Gap was a pinch point. Lake Lewis behind Wallula Gap was over 1,000 feet deep at one point. There's a huge deposit of sediment here that's just associated with everything that got ripped off, was dropped in that area. It pushed through to Lake Condon, and again, some pinch points here as it was entering the gorge. They've estimated that when it hit sort of the mouth of the Columbia here in just east of Portland, it was also close to 1,000 feet high because of the constraints of the gorge. So this was just a huge pipe coming out in Portland. Spread down the Willamette Valley, there are thick deposits of everything from Volkswagen boulders to silt and clay that was deposited in the Willamette Valley. Some interesting features, actually, just to point out. Dry falls, there's lots of really cool features here. Dry falls up at the north end, there's a major channel of the floods. It literally eroded the basalt back. Had these huge falls that must have been just amazing during the eruption. Scablands, this is essentially where the water just sheeted over, ripped off any topsoil, weathered rock, and essentially left rock. And if you head towards Spokane, you'll notice it's pretty desolate in a lot of areas. And that's essentially because everything's been hauled off. I like this. I saw this online, and this is, for those that are familiar with Portland, this is the Coin Tower. And these are just, this area shading in blue is kind of a rendition of some of the paths that the water took. In Portland, we have these small Pliocene volcanic buttes all over the town, Mount Tabor, Council Crest. There's a variety of them. And there's one here, Rocky Point, I believe it's called. Here, it's near the mouth of the Columbia. It's kind of, Highway 84 comes up this way, 205 is just on the other side. And there's a big hole on the west side of this. And it was basically a hydraulic jump where the floodwaters came up and over and scoured out on the backside of that butte. And there's a depression there from these floods. So just amazing. Here's Wallula Gap. If you ever take, instead of going down 82 as you head to from Washington to like the Hermiston area from Tri-Cities, you take 730. It's a highway that's actually on the east side of the river. So this is looking south back towards Oregon, and that's looking north. I apologize. That's looking north. The cliffs are steeper on the south side. At any rate, it's a pretty obvious pinch point if you're putting that kind of water through it. You can see here just somebody's animation, essentially, of this constriction, and all the water literally from that ice dam was forced through Wallula Gap, and it's a pretty dramatic feature. So what does Hawaii and Yellowstone have in common? I thought these were beautiful pictures. they all both are hotspots. And essentially a hotspot is a place where, the other day I talked about how plate tectonics are partially driven by sort of a convection in the earth and or in the mantle. You have large scale convection, you have within those large cells, you can have smaller scale convection. And that's essentially what Hawaii is. It's a hotspot, and it erupts and creates, Mauna Loa and Kilauea and then all the other islands. You'll notice there's the chain of islands, and then it does a bend, and that's essentially a change in how the Pacific plate is moving over that hotspot. So relatively speaking, the plates of the Earth move, and that stays relatively static in hotspots.
So what's convecting?
The actual mantle itself is convecting in a very slow manner, but it's you're essentially getting hotter material moving up and coming up closer to the surface and then dropping as it cools. And we see these same in oceans. We see large currents that are so essentially conveyor belts of warm and cold. There's a warm, the cold water sinks and then rises up near the Caribbean, and it also happens in the Pacific.
But what's the cycle of the mantle? That's got to be a long, long time.
It's a very good question, and I the rate of return of that mantle, it's got to be extremely slow. So we had, Yellowstone is also a hotspot, and the track of that hotspot essentially created the Owyhee Uplands and the Snake River Plains, which are down in, here's Oregon, kind of comes in like this, a lot of it's in Idaho, and then obviously off to Yellowstone in Montana. And it's a relatively young feature. It's Miocene and younger. Yellowstone is quite young. It's still active, essentially. But we have cinder or calderas that have essentially worked their way as, relatively speaking, the North American plate has gone over them, over this hotspot. So it's basically left this track of explosive volcanics that are the form of various calderas and ash sheets and such that punch through the basin and range terrain. And I'll talk about the basin terrain, which is a very large extension system that extends well down through the southwest of the United States. So that was dropped on top of this extension system, and then relatively young, a couple million year old Snake River group basalts flowed over much of this, not quite to the Owyhee Plateau, but much of Idaho. And you can really see this, it's really a flat feature, but you can see this is where the Snake River Plains have come through, and the flows have basically left a very flat plateau. If you've ever driven through there, it's pretty monotonous. These are some of the cones. Some people consider the Steens Mountains basalts associated with Columbia River basalts. There's also volcanics up in Washington, further up in Washington and in British Columbia that also erupted in a similar time frame that they think may all be associated with some sort of large plumbing system that was active in the Miocene. So basin and range, I don't know if that's a familiar term to a lot of folks, but it's essentially where the Earth's crust has been stretched and on the order of in excess of 200% extension of the original ground surface. And that extends from well down past Nevada into Arizona and New Mexico. It creates this really interesting topography where you start with a surface that's pretty flat, you start stretching it, and it's brittle. And then what happens is you get these lithic faults that start to form, and then those blocks are rotated and offset, and then you get these big fill prisms that come in between. So it's really flat, and then you get these mountain ranges that shoot up into the air. And This is down in far southeast Oregon. You can just see all the layers have been sort of back rotated, nice big flat area where material that's shed off of that is filled into the valleys. This area extends well into Oregon. And you know, if you think about it, if you have, it's a little tricky to explain, but you have a sphere and you're stretching a certain part of it, you've got to have edges. You know, we don't see a basin range in British Columbia. So somehow you've got to be able to stretch this, but you have shear points on the sides where that stretching terminates. Some of the big ones are the Brothers Fault Zone and the Olympic Wallawa Lineament, where this is actually a hundreds of small faults that are on echelon, essentially taking up that extension in a series of small faults that allow this part to stretch, whereas up north, it basically doesn't. And that's been active, like I say, well, I think even before the Miocene, but continues today. There's fairly active earthquakes and faulting there. So, all right, so the last stretch that I actually have, I wasn't sure how long this was going to last. That might be a little short, so maybe more time for questions on folks, is the Coast Range. And, you know, there's more slides on this one. Mostly it's pretty recent, and it hasn't been hammered quite as bad as other parts of the country. But, you know, in the sort of in the Miocene or Eocene time, we had a subduction going on the coast. If you remember, I showed there's the Kalua plate and the Farallon plate had split apart, and they were spreading apart, basically creating volcanics and a series of island of sort of volcanic accumulation of volcanics along in a line here. Some people postulate that this is actually associated with the hotspot that created the Yellowstone system. But they have a whole series of volcanics that age. The oldest are on the outside and the youngest is in the middle, which is essentially meaning that as you rifted apart, the old stuff was spreaded further out. These are present all along the coastline of Oregon and Washington as the big bluffs and buttes and high points. At that time, those were still being accreted on or put on, and we had erosion of the Klamath Mountains. This is down in far southwest Oregon, creating this big fan deposit. The Tyee Formation is a very large sandstone grading, sandstone in the south, and then grading into sort of more siltstone with turbidite sequences to the north. That was all underneath. So this is the shoreline, you know, 55 million years ago. So this was all sort of shallow marine environment. We were still underwater at that point. As we got a little younger, there's overlap in the time. Geology time is all squishy anyway. But because of this compression, due to the subduction, the coastal area was actually bulging up. There's a big anticline that runs up the axis of the coastline. And so we ended up with a shallow marine ocean that extended up, coming out somewhere north of Portland. And then this was all actually above water sea line by that time. Miocene age, we had the Columbia River basalts coming out and making it all the way to the coast. What's interesting is that, you know, at that time, you had a lot of really soft muds out there. There weren't rocks at that point. And they couldn't hold up the Columbia River basalts. So they actually went underground and have gone out hundreds of feet, thousands of feet out into the ocean. And basically, as we would call them, a sill or a dike. So once a volcanic goes underground, it's not a lava, it's a sill, it's an intrusive. So it's a shallow intrusive. And they extended it well out past where they sort of intercepted this shallow marine environment. Anybody recognize this location from Oregon?
Haystack?
Yes.
Haystack.
Excellent, well done. Yes, so Cannon Beach, due east of, west of Portland, has these beautiful big basalt columns that are out there, and those essentially are eroded members of this intrusive Columbia River basalt. Get a little bit younger, we're talking, you know, after the Miocene into what's called the Pliocene, which is a slightly younger time period. No more ocean, we're done with the ocean, and we have the sort of proto-Willamette Valley at that point. For those that are familiar with the trout, or with the Portland area, the Troutdale gravels were a significant deposit out there. It's predominantly gravel. And here's this is out in Troutdale, appropriately named, at the mouth of the Columbia River. Sandstone here, which is part of the Troutdale, an interbed of sandstone, and there's just gravels. And you drive up to these things, and maybe 150, 200 feet high, and they're cemented enough that they stand vertical, basically. So that is a deposit that we can track all the way down into the to the coast. A lot of active tectonics that are going on here that continue on to today, essentially. And a lot of these features are remnant, but some of them are still active as far as tectonics on the coast today. This is what the coast looks like. It's a really challenging place to do geology because everything's covered with either trees or soil, or it's a landslide, or it's just it's thickly weathered. So you're out there, it's a lot of this is sedimentary rock, like sand, silts or gravels or siltstone and conglomerate or sandstone, but it's all weathered to soil. So I commend those that spend a lot of time working in the Coast Range. So questions, I should say, just to stop, I didn't also cover the North Cascades. I'm kind of leaving that for tomorrow. It's got lots to go on, and I think people would be more interested in a little more detail on that one. It's a pretty broad brush of Pacific Northwest, but if folks have other questions, yeah.
I was just wondering if you quickly address the Olympics in relative to the coastal range.
Yeah, you know, the Olympics are very similar. They're they've been uplifted by, they're young sedimentary rocks that, in this case, have actually just been uplifted and faulted up to the mountains we see today. So it's the same age rocks as we see to the south. And what they think is that that some of the plate tectonics that the Kula plate was actually rotating in that area, and that's what caused the Olympics to actually essentially rotate up and be uplifted relative to southern Washington, southwestern Washington, and all. But they're some of the youngest mountains in the world, basically. So, but it's just a slightly different how the plate sort of came in on it and caused that. And there's some core metamorphosed metasediments that are present in the center of the Olympics as well. So it's relatively the same age rocks there.
So how old are the clams that I dig in above Marshall Wilderness area?
They could be exceptionally old. I think that's in the Meto terrain, and that's, I believe, like Permian in age.
It's just south of Glacier Park, yeah.
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 We might be able to check that a little bit more, but I think they're, several hundred million years old. So, yeah.
What about Palouse Hills and the mountains?
Yeah, so Palouse Hills are, I believe they are essentially loess deposits, and they're, I kind of brushed over, Columbia River basalts were a huge deposit, but they've also gone through quite a bit of tectonic deformation. There's the Yakima Fold Belt that runs through there that's created these big ridges that we drive. As you drive, you all seem like you're either going up or down in that part of the state. So, that's essentially what's created those, my understanding. Blue Mountains are part of, they are actually part of the exotic terrains. So they've got melanges or groups of exotic landscape that's been sort of rafted onto the North American coast. There's a lot of similarities with those rocks to North Cascades rocks, as well as the Klamaths. It gets a little odd to imagine, but essentially the Klamaths and the Blue Mountains were probably much closer to each other at one time, and there's been sort of a clockwise rotation of the Klamaths on the order of, like, you know, 60 to 90 degrees, the focal point up towards the Olympics, and that's sort of pulled that whole area off to the southwest of Oregon right now. So there's some really neat geology there. It's also super complicated. I could make a whole separate lecture on that one as well. So, yeah.
How do you respond to people that say the world is 6,000 years old?
To me that is a faith-based belief, and you can make the argument that everything was put here exactly the way it was, that the fossils were all created, the layers of rock were all created in a week, and I have more problems with people that want to use the Great Flood as a, how the landscape got to where it was. There's a lot of things that don't make sense there from a geologist standpoint. But to me, that's more of a faith versus sort of a science standpoint. So that's kind of my take on it.
Do you just kind of nod your head and say, let's go have a beer or what?
I haven't had a lot of really intense discussions with folks that have a really strong opinion about that. There are people that do, but I think the majority of folks have a separation between absolute interpretation versus teachings that the Bible represents. So most people sort of say, well, yeah, I feel like there's probably enough evidence to think that that's not the case. It's more of a relative interpretation. Yeah. In the back, yeah.
As you're describing how things happened, in my mind, I'm imagining a simulation, a visual simulation, and how cool that would be to actually watch that. And I presume that people have put those things like that together.
They have. I don't know if they've done anything for the Pacific Northwest. A lot of it's really complicated. Like tomorrow, I'll talk a little bit about, like the core complex, the metamorphic core complex of the North Cascades. The terrains to the west were put on top of that, and it was buried underneath and then exhumed. So I think from a video standpoint, it'd be really hard to kind of show that Pacific Northwest. It was, as I was running around putting a lot of this together, there was a cool video that I did come up with that someone put up, sort of showing the rifting of South America and Africa, and sort of showing some of the different volcanics and how that sort of happened, and it's got a nice little narration and everything like that. But I haven't seen anything like that worked for Pacific Northwest.
What's the most most important geological events going on in our world now? I know it's long time periods, but what do you see as the most?
I think what I was let me go back to the very beginning, and I was thinking about this evening, and I was thinking mostly in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
Let's go to my big old. What's interesting here is, we're about to run out of subducting plate here. We got a little teeny chunk of the Juan de Fuca plate that's going to disappear. And then we're going to basically have a situation where the Pacific plate is moving we call it strike slip, but right next to each other, kind of like the San Andreas and much of California is. And then we have this interesting bulge right here. So are we going to have a little rift here that develops? If this plate continues to move this way, then all of a sudden we've got a hole that's going to form here. So I just looking forward, I think that in a big scale, I think that's going to be really interesting down the road. I also think that it's been awfully quiet from a volcano standpoint.
You consider ice a geological feature?
I do, and I'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow as well. But I, it's, you know, it's left us some amazing scenery out here. You have a question, too?
I think it's real interesting if you go down the Columbia River Gorge, and in certain areas you see it where it's been either uplifted or dropped. And
yep.
And it's the same along the John Day spots.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's amazing to see.
And it's a long ways.
It is. They're just as you come into Hood River, you look across, and the whole package is tilted to the west at about 10, 15 degrees. And that's part of the Yakima Fold Belt. You know, these basalts have all just been sort of arched. In fact, the whole Cascades there north of Mount Hood, there's a big anticline there. When you get to Cascade Locks, and you look at the outcrops, the basalt is like 300, 400 feet above the river level there. And you're actually looking at some late Oligocene, the Eagle Creek Formation, and Gone-McGosh or something like that, terrains that are Western Cascade type terrains that are peeking out from that arching. So there's been a lot of shifting of that, the basalts just in the last 15 million years. So, yeah.
Has our work in space in the last number of, last 20, 30 years had an impact on our understanding of the geological events that are taking place? Remote sensing and that sort of thing.
Sure, yeah. You know, I think of it a little bit more that we've been able to use what we see here on Earth to better understand some of the planetary geology that we see and have observed. An example of this that I looked at when I was in grad school is that depending on the composition of a lava, the surface morphology is going to be very different. And that if you look at basalt lava, which is more mafic and generally more fluid, if you think of like the Hawaiian, the Poihoi surface feature, it looks like ropey lava. So there's just this little continuing ripple marks in the lava. And if you go down to Newberry Crater and you go up to the Palina Peak and you look down on the obsidian flow, you see the same sort of relatively consistent wavelength in the surface morphology. I mean, when you're on the obsidian, it's just this big rubble field of glass. But from above, you can get a sense of that, and that period gives you geological properties, and you can correlate that with composition. So you can go to Mars or someplace else and get a relative sense of the composition of the material that erupted in some of the volcanoes that they see there. So I think that they've been used. It's been the reverse more than looking out and going in.
Well, there's some very important observations from space as far as height changes, growth changes, where something's dropping, where something's coming up that are important.
Like
geosters. Yeah. No, that's you're right. You know, maybe I misinterpreted your question in that there's remote sensing has made huge changes in our understanding of active tectonics. At the very large scale, we also do a lot of flying of the ground surface with a laser. And we mentioned this yesterday, we're scanning large areas of the Earth's surface with a laser that's flying in a helicopter, usually it's a plane, and shooting like little beams of light down on the ground, and on the tune of like 500,000 per second. And it's measuring how fast that light comes back, and you can tell where it reflected off of, and we can essentially get a very high resolution image of the ground surface. It's revolutionized geology and geologic hazards in the Pacific Northwest, because all of a sudden we strip off all that vegetation and the landslides and the faults just boom right there. So So it's fascinating. So, but yes, there's been huge advances from a remote sensing standpoint. Any other thoughts or questions? Great. Okay. Well, thanks everybody for coming out. I have one more tomorrow. It's going to focus on the sort of the more of the North Cascades and sort of closing in on Holden. And I hope that that's a good discussion, because I'll probably learn something from you all that are spending a lot more time than I've had here. So I hope to gain some knowledge from everybody here as well as we work through that. I'm going to have a little bit on the glaciers as well, and some of the impacts of the glaciers, and just some of the cool features that we see out here, just even in the Holden Valley. So, thank you.
Thank you.